Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
Essentially, it's part of a strategy to shift power. We need to shift ownership, assets, wealth, opportunity, etc., as quickly as we can from a concentration of power to those communities and individuals from whom the power was stolen in the first place. Giving banking back to our depositors is our charge. We strive to awaken the agency, that's the choice, and the accountability, that's the responsibility for depositors to have their money sleep with a bank that observes their values.
That's one of our guests today on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, Kat Taylor, the co-founder and chair of Beneficial State Bank in Oakland, California. Kat's bank is one of a growing handful of banks that bank on values, and they're a leading light in implementing the future of banking overall. Hello, and welcome. I'm Walt McCree, Ellen Brown's co-host and colleague at the Public Banking Institute. Is it possible that the industry and institution of banking, namely the lending of credit and the financing of our common needs, can be transformed from its current regime of private profiteering and evolve into something that helps us create, as one of our guests today describes it, an economy worthy of our affection? Can banking become an agency for positive social, economic, and even ecological change? Our guest today will discuss these prospects within a matrix that we'll call regeneration. In other words, we're going to talk about a new world order that redesigns banking's functional roles around evolutionary objectives at a time in our global society history where current banking practices are typically on the front lines of exploitation and extraction. As the economic crises worldwide brought on by the COVID pandemic tears away at the foundations of local and global businesses alike, the subject of money becomes all the more important to address. So we'll dig into that in a few minutes. But first, let's take a look at how this current financial struggle is affecting our own nation's monetary system. Ellen just published a new article in SurePost that describes how ill-equipped that system is to actually get money into the productive economy instead of just Wall Street.
So, Ellen, here we are at the end of the year of a very traumatic year that has just sapped the lifeblood out of our economy and out of many people, and we are beset with a monetary policy that has done not enough for the people. The Federal Reserve supposedly on point to provide relief. Your new article in SurePost is called "Why the Fed Needs Public Banks." So, tell us why the Fed needs public banks, and if I may, I'd like you to describe, as you do in the article, what people I think don't know is that what the Fed is not able to do, even as our central bank, that is to lend directly into the economy.
Right. Well, that is the problem. So it's obvious to us, the public banking people, that we need the Fed, because we need access to their cheap liquidity that all banks get, so we want to be recognized by them, and we need have access to the Fed so that we can deal with other banks. I mean, that's the way the whole system works. We have to be able to work on that other money level, which is the reserve accounts of banks. But what I wanted to write about was that we're not going to the Fed as supplicants, that they actually need us, and it would serve their purposes to have public banks. So the problem is that the Federal Reserve is not allowed to make loans directly into the real economy, and they're not allowed to spend into the real economy. We actually have a two-tiered money system. So what the Fed can create and does create are bank reserves. So when it buys something, it buys assets off the books of the banks with bank reserves, which it just creates by creating numbers on a screen, and it puts them into the bank's reserve accounts. But then the banks themselves can't spend those reserves either. They can make loans, but currently private banks are not making nearly enough loans at a reasonable price for local businesses to help the local businesses. But public banks would. First of all, their costs are lower. They don't have shareholders, private shareholders bleeding out the profits, and they don't have high-paid CEOs. And second of all, a public bank would have it written right in their charter that they're there to help the local economy and to stimulate the local economy, basically with loans. So the public banks are really the missing tool of the Federal Reserve. We had a lot of discussion last week about Treasury Secretary Mnuchin asking for the money back that the Treasury put up for these special purpose vehicles that the Fed and the Treasury worked out together. And so all the brouhaha in the media was that Mnuchin was taking money back that was actually serving the local economy. But the problem was it wasn't serving the local economy, that the special purpose vehicles, their interest rates and terms were so high that they weren't really being used by local businesses. And what they had succeeded in doing was just propping up the bond market, so making rich investors richer. And even then, the Fed is not allowed to buy the bonds directly. So it was really a jawboning exercise, basically, making bond investors think, well, the Fed has our back, so we can go ahead and buy these corporate bonds because the Fed will take them off our hands if need be. But that didn't happen. I mean, it was just it was media hype without the special purpose vehicles being used very much. Now, we know the municipal liquidity facility that was designed to supposedly make loans to state and local governments was too expensive, and so state and local governments haven't been using it. And again, the Fed can't make loans directly to state and local governments, and they're basically begging Congress to do another stimulus bill so that Congress does that by going into debt and issuing bonds, and then the bonds would be sold in the open market through the bond dealers, and then the Fed could buy those bonds from the bond dealers in the open market. But right now they don't have anything to buy that would actually help stimulate the local economy. But meanwhile, of course, we have Congress is deadlocked and they can't come to an agreement on a stimulus program, but hopefully we'll have another stimulus bill soon that will definitely help. But also what would help would be if we have public banks that are acknowledged and recognized by the Fed as banks in good standing, then the public banks can make those loans as well, borrowing at the Fed at 0.25%, which is the rate at the discount window, which is no longer has a stigma attached. So the Fed is sort of telling all banks, come and borrow here, and we'll make it available to any bank in good standing. So that's a very good deal. If we can borrow for almost nothing, obviously our public banks can make very low-cost loans into the community. So there are actually three public banking bills on the books right now that hopefully will make some progress next year. So one is the Public Banking Act, introduced in October, and it would essentially make it easier for public banks to exist. The Federal Reserve would recognize them, set up guidelines and regulations, and give a way for the public banks to get credit. And also the bill would give some grant money to certain local banks, local public banks. And then in September, Senator Bernie Sanders and Kirsten Gillibrand introduced the Postal Banking Act, which we've been arguing for a long time, which would create $9 billion in revenue for the Postal Service, saving it from privatization, protect low-income or rural families and communities from predatory lending, and reestablish postal banking to provide basic low-cost financial services, which is something we did have between 1911 and 1967. It was very successful. And then the third bill, which we've talked about before in this show, is H.R. 6422, the National Infrastructure Bank of 2020, modeled on Franklin Roosevelt's Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which one of the main attractions of this bill is it wouldn't cost Congress anything. What it does is you would do the same thing that the Reconstruction Finance Corporation did and that Lincoln did and that Alexander Hamilton did, using the American system model, where basically you're just creating the money as credit. It's also what the Chinese do, and that's how they have managed to do all this infrastructure building in their own country. The government owns the banks, and so they can just borrow from the banks, which create the credit on their books, and then the loans are repaid with the proceeds from the infrastructure, like trains and energy companies of different sorts.
So we have, again, a very visible collapse or inadequate banking architecture for solving the problems of our society and the people. We've got the Federal Reserve and the Treasury working to prop up basically the existing private banking system, but we have on the horizon some exciting back-to-the-future prospects for bills that would make a difference, that would enable us to both build a future of infrastructure, of financing small businesses, and of reclaiming some democratic control and input on the institution of banking. Hopefully Janet Yellen is excited about these ideas, and the new Congress, all of them, will see this not only the need, but really the necessity that these changes that you're describing will actually take hold. Ellen, we'll talk about this more next time, and congratulations on this great new article, Why the Fed Needs Public Banks, as posted in the Sheer Post. Looking forward to seeing more of your articles there. So thanks very much, and we'll get on with our conversation.
Okay, thank you.
What might the banking world look like in the era ahead? Today, we're going to talk with people who have been at the forefront of imagining and implementing new thinking about those prospects, thinking that centers on the idea of a regenerative economy. Our guests include one of the most prominent values-based bankers in the world, Cat Taylor, co-founder and chair of Beneficial State Bank in Oakland, California, Dr. Edward Cavetto, the director of regenerative design at the Foresight Lab, McKinsey Mako, program director in the Regenerative Justice Cities and Design Program at the Foresight Lab, and Mark Anilsky, an ecological economist, professor, and award-winning author for his development of the foundational principles of an economy of well-being. Our conversation originated on the Public Banking Institute's Public Bank Solution TV show. We started the program by asking Ed Cavetto to describe what a regenerative economy means.
We struck upon this idea of regenerative development when in the late 1990s it became manifestly clear that scientifically and socially sustainable development was not enough, radically not enough. So we struck upon the notion of regenerative development defined this way, that every transaction between every entity, from the family to the nation state to the community of nations, generate net simultaneous measurable gains in ecological, social, and economic well-being. Generate net simultaneous measurable gains in ecological, social, and economic well-being. On the theory that nature has limits, nature bats last, and she wrote the rule book, and if we do not predicate our understanding of the way we need to shift the global economy to respect the fact that it's grounded on nature's gifts and the principles of photosynthesis, nature will say, that was a bad experiment, we'll try another species, and she will extirpate us. On the other hand, if we can find our ethical and higher spiritual centers and regenerate the economy to one that meets that criteria, there's a chance that we can thrive in harmony with nature and continue to play a role in this beautiful symphony of life for many, many eons to come.
Yeah, it does seem like we're in a period of great testing of the human species. I understand that in the wings are the bonobos. They apparently have incorporated the strongest survival ethic, which is collaboration and support. But so I appreciate your bringing this back to nature. I think when we think of regeneration, it's nature is really the best display of that. It always goes in a cycle, it passes through, but it also regenerates itself. Whereas our economy and our systems have been exploitative and extractive and therefore are unsustainable. But of course, regeneration is not just about how long you can keep a thing going. It's really about bringing nourishment back into the system. Well, Kat, banking has been one of the areas that, of course, you're on the hot seat as the only formal banker here. I'd love to hear your intersection or your input on how this theme fits into your notion of banking and what your banking institution is doing in reference to it, a reflection of it.
Well, thanks, Walt. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. Banking is super powerful and drives societal outcomes, not just financial ones. We think of it as the most powerful form of crowdfunding, not that a specific deposit funds a specific loan, but all deposits fund a lending practice. And that's among the six activities of banking that we should really care about being aligned in the public interest. So when we think of our stakeholders, we do not believe the duty of the corporation is to maximize shareholder profit. We believe that corporations should be allegiant to multiple stakeholders and, to Ed's point, simultaneously bringing benefit to them. Our stakeholders include, yes, our shareholders, but also our customers, our colleagues, the communities in which we work, the planet upon which we all depend, and the public interest. And we aligned our governance structure to maintain that allegiance and not fall to financial first and only outcomes. The economic interests of the bank are owned entirely by philanthropic organizations that are governed in the public interest by their bylaws. So we need to get banking in control because it's driving right now a lot of harm. Our motto is we want to create benefit for all and harm to none, because it's the harm that we have to stop in order to realize the benefits. And that harm is hundreds of billions of dollars of fines for extractive predatory products with no change in business because it's just a cost of doing it. The loss of 10 million homes in the last foreclosure crisis, shifting wealth from Black, Brown, and young communities to old white ones, and ecological harm. Even since Paris, $190 billion of finance into coal, which we need a just transition for coal miners, but we cannot afford coal anymore. So that's why we built Beneficial State Bank, to change the banking system for good.
Could you give us some examples about how that manifests with Beneficial's lending and credit issuance?
Sure. So we depend on data-driven outcomes that are measured by third parties to keep ourselves accountable to our triple bottom line mission of social and racial justice, environmental well-being, and financial sustainability. We measure where each loan dollar goes and attribute it to a benefit category, and we make sure that the any harmful categories have a zero after it. Occasionally, I must admit, when we acquire banks, we acquire portfolio that doesn't meet that requirement, but it's an infinitesimal percentage of our lending activities, and we correct it as soon as possible. So we're measuring to make sure that 75% of our loans are creating benefit, none creating harm. The other 25% might be kind of neutral, but that's the preponderance of our lending power, which is important because if you think about it, if the ratio were switched, we'd be reinforcing the extractive economy, and we need to be firmly, squarely behind building the regenerative economy.
Yeah, that's certainly a wonderful report. I'd like to know more about how your bank fits into the national trending and consciousness of bankers. Are you the only one?
No, fortunately, we are lucky in the company we keep. So we are members of the Community Development Bankers Association, which are the community development financial institution banks certified by Treasury to have at least 60% of their loan dollars and units in low to moderate income communities. We actually wish that were the standard for any bank getting FDIC insurance, but for now it's the CDFI banks. We're also members, as you mentioned, of the Global Alliance for Banking on Values, which is the international cohort of banks with triple bottom lines. And we rely on all of those banks for a community of support and practice. And we are trying to create replicable models so that mainstream banks will migrate towards a more beneficial version of banking.
And obviously you're making a profit, of some, presumably, because you can't stay in business without it, right?
Yes, and I don't really like this phrase, but it's true, no money, no mission, particularly because we want to prove that this is a sustainable, regenerative model of banking mm-hmm. that should be represented by all banks. So we need to be able to sustain modest growth and, you know, pay our colleagues what they deserve, which is 150% of living wage in all markets, mm-hmm. not overcharge our customers and still live to fight another day.
That's great, Kat. Thanks. That's a beautiful description, and I think something that will help to guide this discussion, not just here, but really around the country as we see how it's possible for a commercial bank to fill that kind of role. Before I introduce our new guest that just arrived, Mark Anilsky, I wanted to just go to McKinsey, since you were here before, Mark. McKinsey, you're in this wonderful new generation that is beset by a lot of the systemic challenges that we've partially referred to. What's your attitude about this process and the work that you're generating now in this Foresight Lab regeneration discussion?
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for having me, by the way. So I would say my generation definitely understands the holistic view of issues, meaning how everything is intertwined and how impacting one area, as in the economy, can also impact the climate or culture, for that matter. So when we think about banking, I think it's left out of many conversations, especially private banks. It's a sort of hidden ghost that we have not realized that has been perpetuating these disparities that we see across America. And it's something that definitely needs to come to the forefront of our conversations, our marches, because it's definitely, it's impacting, people of color, lower socioeconomic neighborhoods being impacted by predatory private banks. And I think the issues of becoming a private bank to a public one, or just regenerative banking overall, needs to be at the forefront of legislative and cultural shifts.
In your generation, is this conversation something that's totally an outlier, or do you feel that there's some momentum in focusing on new possibilities for an old institution like banking?
Right, definitely. I mean, I personally did not know much about banks until I started working at the Foresight Lab and started looking into finances and economics. So, and I think a lot of people my age and in my generation also don't know as much about private banks and predatory banking. So I definitely think there needs to be some education on that and can be intertwined in these cultural and ecological shifts and movements.
Thanks. Now, I'd like to introduce, really happy to be able to introduce you to our friend Mark Anilsky. Mark is in Alberta, Canada, and he's a noted author, an economist, international consultant, and author of the book, The Economics of Happiness. Mark's work brings into play the notion of happiness and well-being into the economic structure. Mark, tell us a little bit about how your work and your matrix for finance affects this discussion.
So my primary work now is working with Indigenous peoples and helping them basically achieve financial self-determination, create sovereign wealth funds for them, possibly even a bank. I've studied public banking quite forensically in Alberta. We have the Alberta Treasury Branch, which is, 11 times bigger than the Bank of North Dakota. I've studied interest-free banking in Sweden. I know Vancity quite well. So I've been intrigued with monetary policy my whole life. And I have a vision that we can create or restore the power of public banks, central banks, to their rightful place, in which money is now created in parallel with well-being, not simply debt money, as we've seen for 200 or more years since the Bank of England really was founded. So I applaud Kat and your work. I know the Shorebank people. I know we know a lot of the same people, but I'm pretty motivated by working with Indigenous people now whose assets, Turtle Island's assets, were stolen by basically the Corporation of London in England. So we know that path and we know how to restore it, I think, with the same tools that the colonizers used to dominate the matrix, so we say.
When you're working with the native tribes, you realize that they have a lot of assets that they've been putting into mainstream banks. And until now, I believe they've really not considered creating their own banks, public banks, presumably, along that line. Is that their focus, creating public banks that are basically tribally owned?
Well, the chief I met with this morning is a former Canadian military sniper, so he knows the art of war. And his name is Onikanau Sinclair. He says chief is the colonizer's word. We never use the word chief. And Onikanau means leader for this time. And then we had matrilineal structures in the past. Chief and council was an artifact of the colonizer system. And what he wants me to help him with is create the equivalence of Singapore Sovereign Wealth Fund. So we have a shared asset model where the households are shared owners in the shared assets of the nation. The unique thing about in Canada, they call them nations, or 640 First Nations, which means that they're in a sense sovereign nations in their own right. And of course, the logical piece, once you have the sovereign wealth fund or account set up, you can then think about credit and how, creating money is really simple. It's just, it's magic. It's a derivative of the underlying asset, which needs to be valued, but not necessarily only in monetary terms. You have traditional use, you have plants and medicines, which in spiritual laws, which will never be monetized, but they still constitute assets of the nation. So that's what gets me excited. So we just need the tools, the experience like that you have, Kat, and how do you actually operate? Loan origination, what are the mechanics of that? Show me the balance sheet entry or the ledger entries, and we can replicate that within the First Nation environment. They're just still a bit afraid. They're like, still feel like there's a fence around them. And I say, no. You are free now. You are sovereign. Do you understand? You're like Singapore or Norway. And you don't have to be afraid of the shadow anymore.
Kat, any comment about that?
So I'm very sympathetic with all those ends. And in a sense, we started in the private banking world that Mackenzie was talking about and try to pull the model towards public interest by the governance structure, by our commitment to our stakeholders, and eschew the practice of in the main banking system of financial first and only objectives that lead to adverse natural selection, where whoever is willing to do the most heinous behavior gets elevated to the leadership. So I just want to call out the role of culture with these longstanding Indigenous peoples, that rulemaking doesn't hold nearly as well or as permanently as cultural values. And if you think about what's happened in the money system, is we've allowed it to operate without any cultural norms. It's just, it's maximizing profit, period. So we certainly have to change the rules of banking if we want it to be more beneficial. But ultimately, I think cultural norms and cultural shunning is what will keep us all kind of working together in a mutualism instead of a self-interest.
Well, if I could gloss on that, I think that's a really interesting and profound point. And I know Mackenzie and I work on this with our colleagues all the time. The question of valuation, where does value come from? Conventional banking has played games and manipulated markets to create wealth for generations. And the best and most recent instance of it was during the period leading up to the collapse of the economies in 2008. Banks, which were unleashed by the Bush administration, began creating artificial instruments to make money, betting on the likelihood that poor people would not be able to pay their mortgages. They then, in the crisis of 2008, began ginning up betting pools to try to buy the insurance companies, the insurance policies of the poor people and the elderly that they had put out of homes, to buy their policies because they would need to cash them in and liquidate them to survive. this kind of predatory game playing and artificial creation of wealth, as opposed to backing value with natural system assets, is exactly where we need to shift. And Kat is 100% right. And I know McKinsey thinks about this a lot as her generation tries to express their cultural aspirations to shift the view from one of artificial manipulations of markets to one where value is predicated on truly appreciated natural gifts and community gifts, which is the only way to shift economic variables in such a way is that people can have dignity in the way they use and relate to their money.
That's a really profound kind of a distinction that you're making that's very important, foundational for all of our work. In public banking, of course, I think we're driven by the same instincts and commitments. It's been said that sustainability, in fact, this is a quote from a piece about a solution for the economy in Bangladesh. It says, we've seen that sustainability and responsibility in finance and investment requires an ethics. And by ethics, not meant ethical investment, but a telos of awareness of the social interconnections forged by financing activity. Those are a lot of big words, but I think what we're talking about here is that money is a relationship, and that we're discovering in the paucity of its supply for those who need it, that we're exposing the broken relationships that we have in society and in the economy, in which some people benefit and others are left out of the picture altogether. So the conversation is certainly about the foundation of the institution of banking, but it's really about relationship as well, I would say. And in this first section of our discussion, we wanted to focus on banking, and we have a few more minutes. I'd really like to hear what anyone has to contribute about how the public banking model fits into achieving the goals and the priorities that we've been reflecting here.
I think McKinsey's got a take on this. We just finished an essay where we talked about the role of companies, including banks, carrying on the work of social and cultural change. And if we think about Beneficial State Bank, it is an activist organization. I won't say company because it's philanthropically owned, but it has a point of view. And McKinsey, this might be a good place to gloss this as we think about public banks as moving and living in the world differently to conventional predatory banks.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like traditional banks today barely have a triple bottom line, if even a double, mainly just a single bottom line of just making money, a profit. And I feel like it also should include people and the planet as well. And then, you know, needing to turn a profit to be able to keep the business going. We wrote our essay basically on having a business being not only an activist one, but also being an anti-racist one, if we're relating this back to social justice and what's happening today in our society and wanting cultural and systemic shifts, because our economy is very predicated on and bends the government a little bit and in those in power. So we feel if we can alter the government and the economy, then we can have this cultural shift and systemic shift that we need for everyone to be able to succeed in America.
Mark, any comments from your perspective about the nature of banking?
Well, I've certainly examined the role of the Alberta Treasury Branch, which was, as North America's largest public bank, and because it's an arm of the Alberta Treasury, so in theory, the public bank can create enough credit for the province backed by the assets, if there even was a balance sheet, because there's no balance sheet that we govern on. But the idea that ATB right now during COVID could actually be extending at-cost loans or credit to undercapitalized assets is a real possibility. The disappointment I have as an Albertan is we have a premier in government that doesn't appreciate the power of what we have. We established that public bank during the Great Depression by an interesting premier who was a Bible, he was a preacher, and he studied Douglas's model in England, social credit. And so that was the birth of ATB after the Bank of North Dakota. So my question is, as California and others are attempting to implement their own public banks, is do we have to think seriously about the architecture of the structure in which the credit is going to be created, which I think needs to be grounded on a fundamental accounting system that that measures assets in terms of well-being and impact in terms of well-being impacts in the community. I don't think that's been executed yet in any capacity. The central bank, the Bank of Canada, finally is holding more, I call them COVID bonds, because governments have to deficit finance. That's the only way we did it in World War II. And here we are again. And the only question the Bank of Canada governors, how much debt can you hold and therefore forgive after the pandemic's over? Like those are, mm-hmm. those things aren't being debated by at high levels in Canada yet, but they need to be. And I'm not even going to talk about the Federal Reserve at this point. But
that's good. There's a lot to say about that. We're listening to a discussion about the role that banking and finance can play in a new world economic setting that reprioritizes bank objectives to reflect values and practical imperatives. Our guests are Kat Taylor, co-founder and chair of Beneficial State Bank in Oakland, Dr. Edward Cavetto, the director of regenerative design at the Foresight Lab, and McKinsey Mako, a program manager at the Foresight Lab, as well as Mark Anielski, an ecological economist, professor, and award-winning author for his development of the foundational principles of an economy of well-being. I asked Ed to remind us what the notion of a regenerative economy means.
Our notion is that this is a gesture that goes beyond sustainable development, which really is about making things less awful. Regenerative development contemplates net simultaneous measurable gains in the forms of well-being that support life on the planet, ecological first, social second, and economic last. And I would say that the notion of regenerative development in this larger context means shifting the institutions of civil society, the private sector, the public sector, the government sector, the educational sector, and the activist sector, toward creating these kinds of regenerative gains in a setting in which all the signals of the system, the ecological signals and the climate catastrophes that are driving us, the social signals and the everything from the collapse of civil society in some nations to the collapse of civility and social justice in our own countries, and to the economic shocks that come with not being resilient enough to withstand a global pandemic. And that comes from having a global economy predicated on vaporware rather than a localized economy predicated on real value and values. All those risks can be solved at a stroke if we take the approach of pursuing a regenerative future.
And Kat, in your industry and in your unique bank, Beneficial State Bank, how does this principle get applied and managed? How are you expressing this priority, reprioritization?
So Beneficial State Bank observes allegiance to a variety of stakeholders. It does not maximize profit for the shareholder, which to us is a fallacious conception of the corporation. So first among those stakeholders are really our depositors. Deposits in the American economy alone amount to $12 or $13 trillion of power on an annual basis that can be deployed into loans and investments that are aligned with values of our primary stakeholders, starting with depositors, moving quickly to all customers, colleagues, the communities we serve, the planet upon which we depend, and the public interest at large. So essentially, it's part of a strategy to shift power. We need to shift ownership, assets, wealth, opportunity, et cetera, as quickly as we can from a concentration of power to those communities and individuals from whom the power was stolen in the first place. When everybody owns a little bit of everything and nobody owns too much of anything, we thrive. In the opposite, we suffer. Mm-hmm. So giving banking back to our depositors is our charge. We strive to awaken the agency, that's the choice, and the accountability, that's the responsibility for depositors to have their money sleep with a bank that observes their values.
And of course, from a public banking perspective, it's very consistent. Kat, in the vis-a-vis the emerging public banking trends around the country, your bank is a private bank. Looks like it would have a very collaborative future with public banks as they emerge, and perhaps that you would be able to and would be bringing forward the community bank ecosphere into a new realm of that kind of service.
So we aligned our governance with the public interest as a way of taking a private institution and making it complementary to public banking and a regenerative economy. 100% of our economic rights are held by a foundation that's permanently governed in the public interest. Mm-hmm. But we're very sympathetic to the plight of establishing public banks in each state and maybe a federation of them nationally, and having them have subsidiary banks that extend right down to the local level. It's time that the public had more of a say about the money markets and the capital markets and where that investment power goes, where that lending power goes to support our municipalities, to support climate change mitigation, to support renewable energy, an alternative to community safety, and all sorts of goals that we share but are not achieving reality through the current financial system.
Are there regulatory constraints that you have to deal with in order to realize your mission?
The regulators are pretty serious about safety and soundness.
Yeah.
So we do have to turn a profit, but we constrain our profit goals to that which does not suggest that we're ever underpaying our colleagues or overcharging our customers. Mm-hmm. And the mission outcomes are equally or even foremostly valued ahead of or alongside profit making.
Yeah. McKinsey, as you look at the future of banking and finance in a regenerative way in for the new generation, we understand that the money really rests with older folks who have acquired it all this time, but the whole notion of acquiring assets and growing wealth, is that still a preoccupation or a primary concern for people in your generation?
I wouldn't say necessarily, no, I wouldn't say that. I would say it's less of a individualism thing and more of a holistic cultural thing. So uplifting those around us and wanting our brothers and sisters to be the best they can be. And that's sort of fulfilling more than, you know, turning over a profit or getting a really good job to be like super rich. Like that's, I feel like my generation is less worried about money and more about others wanting to reach their full potential.
Do you have any formulations in mind about how you think it would look for banks to be more accessible for people in your generation and for the incoming days?
Yeah, definitely. Well, like I said earlier, private banks are pretty predatory, especially against college students and even people of color, Black and brown communities, poorer communities. And we would like to see the shift from private to public banking, where it is more inclusive and people in these groups that have difficulties accessing banks or getting loans that they need can actually have that. But on top of being able to get housing loans and afford it, as well as, you know, accessibility to better food and better nutrition, to also take that next step to help these communities to self-actualize. And Ed can add a little bit more to that about exactly how that would work. But taking that next step from helping these communities finding food and housing to helping these people reach their full potential in their lives. So,
Ed, you want to gloss on that a little
bit? Yeah, thank you, McKinsey and Kat, for setting the table so nicely. If we think about the simple pyramid of needs drawn by Maslow, where shelter and food are at the bottom of the pyramid, it's critically important that innovative and disruptive financial institutions like Beneficial State Bank and others provide that for the disadvantaged communities, for the least among us. But it is entirely possible and more than conceivable, but actual, that financial institutions properly governed can drive well-being at the higher levels of Maslow's hierarchy of needs towards self-actualization. For example, Triodos Bank was designed in the Netherlands when it was created in the 1990s. To work along that continuum. And one of the things that they do now in every community where they have a branch is they host conversations teaching cultural entrepreneurs how to launch enterprises that serve the public good, but also call upon their higher personal calling. Teachers and doctors and clergy find their calling. They don't just have a job. They don't just have a career, but they have the highest aspiration of their abilities as human beings realized through their work. And Triodos has an explicit remit to help people that are their depositors and their customers and are beneficiaries of their beneficial banking model achieve their highest potential. It is about what Kat said. It's governance and power. And if we demand of our financial institutions, they do nothing less than act in the public interest and regulate them through our central banking schemes to drive that, we can achieve this kind of cultural transformation and all be the better off for it. If we don't do that, our financial institutions will lead us into the ditch and continue to concentrate wealth in the most wealthy families and companies, and all of it at the expense of nature and the majority of human beings.
Mark, your work with First Nations is also driven out of a very strong sense of community and common purpose, which of course is a very democratic sort of a composition. Tell us what you're seeing and how that development is taking place.
You know, as an ecological economist and a professional forester, or lapsed professional forester, thanks. Good friends of Gifford Pinchot and the third, I naturally think of forests as the ultimate, or the watershed as the ultimate ecological framework to work from. And Indigenous people know that even the language in banking, currency, banks, liquidity, all have water metaphors. So fundamental to this is the laws of nature, the laws of water, which Indigenous women carry literally in their DNA. So everything has to be based on the rearticulation of these laws, upon which then, if you see in my background, I have seashells. They were the original form of money from the Polynesian, the Indigenous people of Taiwan, which gave rise to wampum, which was the inspiration of Ben Franklin, et cetera, et cetera. You just go to Onondaga, upstate New York, and you will come into a matrilineal culture in which it's still a clan-based culture where the men are elected by the women to represent the clans, not the other way around. Upon which then you have a system in which you can create credit or liquidity based on the shared assets of the households that constitute the nation. So all of that then follows the natural asset principles or natural law principles, which is, well, liquidity is just a derivative of a healthy watershed. So one of the things I worked on was called the Earth Dollar, an attempt to create a cryptocurrency associated with the Ottawa watershed in Quebec for the Algonquin people. And we showed that we could easily create just enough money for everyone to have a living wage and heal the watershed and still have GDP, but not at the rate we have it today, and tie directly to the aspiration of better well-being. That's a very simple bottom line, right? And the word wealth means a condition of well-being, so it fits etymologically. So all of this is kind of putting Humpty back together and going back to those Indigenous cultures of Turtle Island, saying maybe we forgot our origins, or we've misinterpreted your wisdom, and we're not going to go back to seashells because now we have blockchain and we have all this other fancy digital stuff. But it's an exciting future. So regenerative resilience, all of that is Indigenous, I would say, to this conversation.
I loved your analogy to water, you know, that currency, banking even, you know, liquidity. I hadn't ever put that in connection with money, although certainly that's what money is this flow between us. And Kat, you know, the flow between us that you've engendered and enabled with your lending has set some new standards in public awareness. How do you see the future of the industry of banking as it's currently formulated, morphing into a bigger role along the lines of what we're talking? What do you think the architecture is going to look like for banking in the future?
So I think what we're proposing in banking is squarely at the heart of decolonizing wealth, investments, loans, and grants, to borrow Edgar Villanueva's parlance. And when I mentioned it's important that we shift assets, that's really about control and self-determination, self-actualization, as Mackenzie was saying. And we have longstanding cultural models for that in the Indigenous peoples, but we need to modernize our finance system. So not just looking at banking as crowdfunding and according back the control and power to the depositors, but also in philanthropy, shifting assets, not the 5% of the grant making, but the actual assets to use the grant making to increase the capacity for capital absorption in Black and Brown and Indigenous communities, and then shift the assets and get out of the way. I'm also highly in favor of cooperative business models, both worker cooperatives, community held assets, and also something new called, or new old, called platform cooperatives, where when we engage in social production by shopping, sharing, querying, containing content, creating content, and so on these big natural monopoly platforms like Google, YouTube, Netflix, et cetera, that we get compensated for that socially as well, so that over time, verified by blockchain, everybody has a micro share of equity in these large platform cooperatives. So we keep them honest to our values. We also eliminate desperation, which is very expensive to society, because everyone will have assets, mm-hmm. not just current income.
It's a really important point, Walt, if I could just gloss it briefly. One of the most brilliant things about Beneficial State Bank is the business model, and we could spend a whole half hour just on that. But the business model of the future is the cooperative. If you take a conventional view about how the cooperative works and innovate that, there's an emerging new model called the perpetual purpose trust that we honed with our friends over at RSF Social Finance for a wonderful company in Oregon called the Organically Grown Company. The perpetual purpose trust is a model that takes the founding vision of a community of interest, it might be a family, it might be a group of co-founders, and projects it out 100 years to make sure that that vision and the measures of well-being that the organization exists to drive remain in place. And it's a beautiful model for countervailing the pressures in the American economy that deprive women and people of color from owning farms over the long term. This is one of our most important cultural assets, is small farms. The current financial structures are built to deprive women and people of color of small farm holdings and consolidate them in companies like Archer Daniels Midland, Bayer, and Monsanto, and others. Countervailing that with innovative models that are charismatic, that draw attention, and that pull the hearts of people forward into a place where we can talk sensibly about love in the workplace and love in the boardroom, as asking the question, how much do you love this company? How much do you love what we stand for? And can we bring this emotion in a sensible and non-naive way to bear in the workplace for everyone to actualize, where we ask, how can our company, our bank, our cooperative help everyone here achieve their highest potential as a person? And in asking that question, we can ask the question, can our society live up to those standards? And Beneficial State Bank is the future of banking in that context.
I can certainly see that, and I'm totally in support of it. I really look forward to melding these missions and business models, because the cities and states, what you've all been just describing, is the diminishment of our reliance on a global structure, on the macro financialization of the world that has winners and losers and leaves most people in the latter category. So bringing our economies and bringing our systems back to a much more local focused basis in terms of interchange, but also in terms of our priorities and our commitments, and the idea of bringing equity back into the community. Mark, I think you have an example that I've really appreciated, the Habitat model, in which equity is really moved in a sort of a perpetual way from one owner to another, and that what results is ownership without the overhead of growing debt. Can you just say a couple of words about that? We've got a few more minutes here, and I'd just like to share that image.
Well, I had the pleasure of evaluating Alberta's affordable housing program, affordable housing, low rental, subsidized rental, but Habitat stood out. So we did a well-being ROI on it, which was interesting because everyone wanted just a cost benefit. And we said, we're going to actually talk to the tenants about their well-being impacts or experience of any one of these affordable housing programs. And Habitat came out as a shining light. So the beneficiaries of the Habitat households were off the charts in terms of subjective well-being. Hmm. And so I went to Habitat Edmonton and I said, what is it? I want to do a forensic accounting of your model. Like, you do interest-free mortgages, you do 500 hours of sweat equity. Maybe that's the component that's critical. And then I was invited to the Economic Compassion Initiative in Cincinnati by Walter Brueggemann and Peter Block and John McKnight, some of you know. And they said, come and teach us about how we could become each other's banker. And I said, we could actually build a fund here in Cincinnati that mimics habitat, that restores distressed old houses that can't even be bulldozed for $1,000 by the city, and restore them to their former glory, and put a low-income household into an interest-free mortgage like Habitat, and be debt-free in 10 years, right? And we played it out on Excel spreadsheets. We knew it could work. I took it back to Edmonton. I said, Habitat can fashion an at-cost or zero-interest mortgage in a very creative way. So it, in fact, it is a credit union. It's not de facto credit union yet, but it's doing something that is give that low-income household about $9,000 to $10,000 of workable income. It's the savings they would have avoided in paying for a conventional mortgage, which right. They would have never received from the conventional banks. So it was just an extraordinary insight into how we could free people from the burden of debt. The poor would actually be happier even than the middle class in Cincinnati, I surmised. Right.
That's great. Mark, thank you for framing out that image for us, because I think you gave some important examples of realities that we can move toward as a way of rebalancing the social injustice and institutional injustices that we're living with now. Anything else that you'd like to throw in before we have to say goodbye on this?
I actually do have something to add. So, yeah, I think I might have mentioned this, but I feel like my generation understands that social justice, environmental justice, and economic justice are all intertwined and interconnected with one another. And we feel that we can tackle all three problems at the same time. You know, we're not just marching in the streets for social justice, but we're also marching to save our planet, you know. And it can be done. You know, we can focus on banking, but these banks can also focus on saving the environment while also, you know, developing a culture in a community nearby. And just recently, the Dutch government actually decided to combine their economic affairs with their climate policy, all while having the Royal Dutch Shell Company, which is like one of the largest oil companies in the world, being like they were in favor of this combining between economic and environmental policy together, so that if they were to make a economic decision, they also have to think about the impacts it will have on the environment now, but also in the long term. And I think that our federal government has an obligation for future generations to do the same.
Thanks once again to McKinsey Mako and Dr. Edward Cavetto of the Foresight Lab, Kat Taylor of Beneficial State Bank, and Mark Anielski of Anielski Consulting for this conversation from our TV show, The Public Bank Solution. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.